Talk Radio 790 KABC. Welcome to the Frank Sontag Show on this rainy Friday evening. The storm of the century. You know, we live in a drought state, everybody. It's like this will come and go. Tens of millions of gallons will wash out to the sea, and we'll be hearing the politicians tell us in about a week and a half we again have to ration water, and you better not water your front lawn or else. It's just hypocrisy to the nth degree. Welcome to the broadcast. Tonight, I've got some stories. I have a commentary. Many of you heard me read about 6 weeks ago, and you have asked me to reread it. Now, I'm of the mindset that, realistically, not everyone hears every week's broadcast, and there are many of you maybe listening right now. You've never heard the show before. You're punching buttons or whatever. But it's a commentary that speaks today as well, and it's about the topic of fear. Y'all remember it wasn't that long ago that we had the lockdowns, and for 2 years we just heard everything from the imposition of experimental drug mandates all the way to, you know, if you don't kowtow to the government and the entities and the powers that be, you're in for it big time. And a lot of people kowtowed. A lot of people went belly up. I'm a follower of Christ. We're not supposed to, as I understand the Bible, we're not supposed to really be afraid. And when I did afternoon radio in this town for 8.5 years, I was on during about the first year and a half of the lockdowns. I was actually somewhat shocked by the amount of people that would call in, identify themselves as Christians, and just talk about how terrified they were of this virus. And I just couldn't help but think of the Bible talking about there will be a day where Jesus says, "Leave me, I never knew you." Like, fear? And I'm realistic. There are things in life that we are to be afraid of. If you've ever backpacked the backside of Tuolumne Meadows up in Yosemite by yourself in the middle of bear season, it can get a little funky out there. If you're in your sack in the middle of the night, and you hear noise and you open up your tent and there are bears walking around, that's a little scary. But for the most part, those that seek power know the drill, know the formula. And a lot of it has to do with bombarding the masses with fear. And it works. Stanley Milgram did it, I believe, in the 20s. It was either at Harvard or Yale. It's known as the Milgram experiment. If you don't know it, let me give you about 2 minutes of what the Milgram experiment was. Stanley Milgram was a brilliant scientist. And so he had the idea of seeing how far he could push someone to hurt another human being. But it was a ruse. It was all a setup. So what he did was he hired actors, found a laboratory, and set up this makeshift board, and he would have students come in and tell them, "We're conducting serious research in science, and so here's the drill. You have three knobs here, and I'm going to tell you, turn the knobs. A is mild, the middle one is a bit more extreme, and the C, the final one, can be almost lethal," where he would tell them they would have to initiate the shock to someone in another studio who was an actor, but the student didn't know it. They thought it was all legit. So Milgram, one by one, brought in students, ran them through the drill, and would systematically work his way up to what would be perceived as a lethal charge. And I think, if I remember correctly, the statistic was 85% of the students, even though they hemmed and hawed and kind of squirmed, they initiated what they believed was a near lethal shock to the person in the other studio, all under the auspices of science. I was kind of raised in rock and roll. Peter Gabriel did a song years ago called "We're Do What We're Told." The masses can be lemmings. We just lock, stock, and barrel. Hey, take care of me. Government, you know, if I'm afraid, I want to have the sense of security, which is a false sense of security. I mean, the things that happened during COVID, now truth always comes to light. But now some of the investigations and some of those, the true medical elite are coming forward, those that were censored and blocked and deleted. Robert Malone, Peter McCullough, my good friend, the late Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, who has a Twitter page and they're keeping that going. But they were ones that tried to speak out from the very beginning that there was more to the virus than what we were being told. And so now we're finding out. I'm not necessarily a huge proponent of Elon Musk. I think he's got some great ideas, and I think he's got some weird ideas. But at least on Twitter now, you're starting to get another part of the story versus what we lived with. The moment the doctors in the white overcoats had their summit in D.C. early on in the pandemic, and they were talking about treating patients with ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, and that was shut down. Vladimir Zelenko was the first in New York, treated hundreds of patients that had COVID seriously. He treated them with hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, and zinc sulfate, and I think he lost maybe two. Maybe two. And then he became high profile when he had the audacity to send then-president, believe it or not, Donald Trump, a letter talking about the value of hydroxychloroquine. And you may remember, all of a sudden, Trump started talking about hydroxychloroquine, and then, bad. Anything that came out of the former president's mouth, you know it. The left hates him. The media hates him. Still now. They're blaming the Ohio train derailment on Trump. Did you see Pete Buttigieg the other day? It's just amazing how stupid we can be as masses. So I think what I'll do, first of all, I'm being prompted to give out the numbers, 800-222-KABC, 1-800-222-5222. If you want to jump on board, have any comments or questions on this topic, or if you listen to the program at all, it's on anything. We just open the phones and take your calls, and a little insight into what happened last week that I'm still wondering about. I've been in radio a few years. I'm not a guy that worries about the ratings and tries to be sensationalistic or controversial or confrontative. I just get on the air, crack the mic, and try to present information in a balanced manner. And ultimately, you're the one that decides for yourself. I believe in personal responsibility. I believe in agreeing to disagree. Civil, respectful disagreement, not the crap that we're dealing with or we dealt with cancel culture and critical race theory and some of our college students. My goodness gracious, they got to have safe spaces and they're offended. And what kind of generation are we raising? I have a men's ministry. I took a call from a young man, I'll never forget it, about 3 years ago. He called my program and said, I am a college student at such and such university. He said, I was forced in front of my classroom to apologize for being a young white man. Just apologize. He didn't do anything. You know, the shaming going on. I think of young men, my men's ministry. We try to breathe the fire of Christ into men, challenge them to step up and be men of God. And I won't speak for anybody but myself. I've done a lot of dumb things in my life. I got radically saved in 09. I praise God that the God I follow is a forgiving God. It's not 10 steps to perfection so you get into heaven. It's an ongoing exercise in slowly, if you don't know anything about Christianity, it's called sanctification. Slowly, as time goes on, you become more and more convicted in your, get ready, horrible three-letter word. I know this is secular radio. Wait for it. It's called sin. A word that is barely spoken in churches anymore. But I digress. What's my point here? We're like a ship in the middle of the sea, lost our moorings. We've turned our back on God. I believe in evil. I've not always believed in evil. I was a New Age teacher for 21 years. Thought evil was the lack of good and love. It's not a force. We just all have to get together and sing Kumbaya and it's all good. Yeah, right. Evil does exist. And actually, it doesn't even hide itself anymore. Look at what's going on in our state, our country, our the world, our culture. I love music. What happened to the Grammys? Satanic worship openly. And the masses applaud. So when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about this concept of fear and who should really be afraid. Neil Oliver is a British filmmaker. He did this commentary I want to read to you and remind you again, if you'd like to be on the program, we have a wide open board, 800-222-5222, 800-222-KABC. You'll talk to Adam when you call in the program. He's the man that screens you. Wayman is on master controls, and I'm here every Friday night from 7 until 9. Would love to hear from you. Questions, comments, anything at all. 800-222-KABC. And we will continue with more of this, the Frank Sontag Show, Talk Radio 790 KABC. Talk Radio 790 KABC. Welcome to the Frank Sontag Show. The topic of fear is something that I think we all have some type of a relationship with. Neil Oliver, among many things, is a British filmmaker and oftentimes takes to social media to share commentaries. He shared this one in December of last year. It's entitled, They Should Be Afraid. Let me read it to you. And again, you're invited to call the program, 800-222-KABC. Neil Oliver writes, people write to me every day to tell me they fear the future. People from all over the world, all ages, all walks of life. I say this, we should not be afraid. If anyone should be afraid, it is our government. Again, he's talking about Britain, the UK, but I think it applies here too. The whole of Parliament, the state, and the establishment. They should be afraid because they are in the wrong, doing wrong things and behaving unforgivably. You can tell they're afraid by the way they keep doing more and more, faster and faster to make the people poor, cold, and hungry, also demoralized, anxious, and fearful about the present, never mind the future. The fear felt by people around the world is the deliberate consequence of the actions of so-called leaders all across the West and beyond. I say again, we should not be afraid. Those plotting and working against us, against our interests, both as individuals and as sovereign states, have no power and no money other than that which we, the people, grant them. They're supposed to use that power and money to protect us, to keep us free, and to provide opportunities for those hardworking free people to make happy and successful lives for themselves. Instead, they're working night and day to have us welcome a state of being that is nothing less than digital enslavement. Many of the people who contact me ask, what should we do? How can we fight back? Neil Oliver writes, I think about the answers to those questions all the time. Right now, I wonder what would happen if those who are cold in their homes, millions of people, just turned on their heating and turned off their direct debits and standing orders. What would happen if when the bills came, we all just agreed to toss them on the fire, all of us together? What would happen if millions of us peacefully acting as one just stood together in quiet defiance? I could be wrong, but I don't think there's enough cells in the prisons, enough judges to hear the cases. If the system wasn't already broken by them, such actions would break it. What would happen if we all withdrew our money from the banks on the same day? What would happen if we all asked, as we are entitled to, for the cash? The banks don't have the money to meet all those demands, and so presumably they would close their doors. Then what? Would their inability to pay out all that cash be evidence of the fraud that is fiat money? I wonder. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The social contract, that notion by which we surrender power to the state in return for services and safety, is broken beyond repair. They broke it, not us. Successive governments, not just the present bunch of cardboard cutouts, have over decades knowingly and deliberately betrayed every aspect of that contract. It is null and void, and we, the blameless party, are no longer bound by its conditions. We, the people, the sovereign people of this country, do not just hold the power. We are the power. We loan some of it, a short-term loan, to governments. And those governments are supposed to serve us, do our bidding, never the other way around. We tell them what to do. Hundreds of years worth of governments has quietly and secretively presided over a financial system that is no more than state-sanctioned fraud. Power to create money out of thin air was put in the hands of an entirely private, unelected, unaccountable business, and this power has been abused to make a tiny group unimaginably rich by enslaving all of us with debt. That system is now on the point of collapse. The West is bankrupt, and governments and bankers are scrambling to solve a problem, how to subtract every last shekel from the people, while still having a handful of wealthy bankers and their enablers left over. I'm reading a commentary from Neil Oliver, who lives in the UK. Britain, he says, has no functioning border against the rest of the world. Hundreds are arriving in this country every day and night, many ferried across the channel by agencies paid for by British taxpayers. British people have to wait longer for health and social care and accommodation to make way for economic migrants with their eyes on a soft touch who have paid illegal gangs thousands of pounds ahead to get here. They send their luggage on ahead and collect it at their hotels. We're at the back of the queue while anyone else from anywhere else is looked after hand and foot. And always, the loudest calls are not for stopping it, but for more money and faster processing. I wonder if the illegal immigration isn't just convenient for the state, softening up the citizens for a supposed solution, like digital ID, perhaps. And then borders open once and for all. I just wonder. The British people are no longer kept safe by the police force they pay for. Burglaries of properties and assaults on the person are barely investigated, while officers prioritize thought crimes on social media. Uncounted thousands of little girls are abandoned to organize gangs of rapists up and down the country because the state turned a blind eye to the relentless raping of children rather than ruffle community feathers. A tenth of the population is on the waiting list for treatment by the NHS. The National Health Service is not keeping the nation healthy. All this about free at the point of delivery is about as much as a magic spell. You can call a lunch a free lunch, but you'll still be left hungry if you can't get into the restaurant. So-called free steaks won't fill you up if you have to wait so long in the queue you starve to death in the meantime. Free becomes another word for something you've heard about but cannot have. And then Neil Oliver says, I say it again, though, we have nothing to fear. Not if we decide to be unafraid. In many ways, the worst has already happened. We've been shown where we stand in the eyes of the state, which is beneath their contempt. I don't have the answers to all of the questions, but I know this much. Even just asking them, airing the thoughts, should make the government, the state, the establishment sit up and pay attention. More and more strikes are happening. Rail workers, teachers, university lecturers, nurses next. What about the self-employed who were abandoned for the last 2 years? They cannot strike. What would happen if they withheld their taxes? All at the same time, I just wonder. But history tells us we should never underestimate the power of the many. Just over 100 years ago, during World War I, thousands of workers were pulled into the city of Glasgow to work in the munitions factories. At that time, there wasn't a single council house or flat in the whole of Britain. Private landlords owned 100% of homes for rent. They could and did raise rents as often as they wanted. Tenants either paid up or were evicted. In February 1915, landlords across the city told tenants the rents were going up by as much as 25%. This was against a backdrop of the steeply rising cost of living generally, food scarcity, and the rest. There was a war to win, remember, and sacrifices were expected from the people if the enemy was to be defeated. In the case of many homes, the man of the house was away fighting in the war, leaving just women and children. Into this crisis for poor people stepped Mary Barber, an ordinary Glasgow woman with two children. She and others realized their only hope lay in sticking together. A mass non-payment campaign got underway. Arrears built up, and soon sheriff's officers were turning up to demand back rent or to evict non-payers. But whenever anyone got wind of an eviction, hundreds of women would descend on the address and block the entrance to the home. A Glasgow MP, William Reid, described a typical incident, quote, "A soldier's wife in Parkhead had an eviction notice served on her, with a warning that if she failed to vacate her house by 12 noon, the sheriff's office would call to enforce it. The strike committee got busy. They instructed every mother in the district with a young child to be there by 11 a.m. on D-Day. Long before noon, the clothes and street were packed with moms and children, and every child had at least one other youngster with them. No raiding party could have gotten near the house. Moreover, the men of Parkhead Forge and other works in the district decided to down tools at 11:30 a.m. and lend a hand if necessary. People began to talk about Mary Barber's army. On 17 November, 18 tenants appeared in court for eviction." Tens of thousands of Glasgow people lined the streets outside. In the end, on 25th November 1915, rents were frozen at pre-war levels. The Increase of Rent and Mortgage Interest Act of 1915 was passed, and some elements of it remained in force as of late of 1989. I wonder what would happen if all of us, opposed to what is going on now, came together like those Glasgow women of 1915 and just say, no, I wonder. When thinking about that time, I'm reminded of real leaders. I've been talking again this week about Ernest Shackleton, who, when all seemed lost, his ship sunk beneath the Antarctic ice with nothing but flimsy tents, three little boats, 28 men trapped on the pack ice, depending on him for life itself. He said, well, now we'll go home. Our so-called leaders tell us our lives must be filled with hardship while they warm themselves in centrally heated homes paid for with our taxes and look forward to Christmas parties and food and drink and decorations paid for by all of us. That is not leadership. That's an abusive relationship. Shackleton put himself through every hardship he expected his men to endure. He did it first and for the longest. What he asked of them, he did too. He said they should leave behind on the ice anything that would not help them keep them alive. Some saying he walked to a hole in that ice and dropped his gold watch and a cigarette case to the bottom of the ocean. He led from the front every step of the way and over nearly 1,000 miles of the cruelest sea on earth. And in the end, he got each and every man home. They called him the boss. Listen to this next sentence. He cared not a jot for the comforts of home. My comment, we are so comfortable. Comfort is death. Back home once more, Shackleton wrote, we had pierced the veneer of outside things. We'd suffered, starved, and triumphed, groveled down and grasped at glory, grown bigger in the bigness of the whole, end quote. Finally, he was a leader who saw that it was a shared endeavor and shared striving that made all else possible. Our leaders would pick our pockets for any gold watches and valuables before climbing aboard their private jets and flying home, leaving us behind on the melting ice. Oliver says, I say we owe them nothing, not our loyalty, not our obedience. If we continue to comply, we build our own prison around ourselves for their benefit. They've promised us the earth while stealing it from us, raping and pillaging its resources only for their own enrichment. I say again, there is nothing to fear if we have each other. And here's the thing. If we set a course for ourselves and back each other every step of the way, we will cross this ocean of darkness together all the way to where we want to be. Neil Oliver. I welcome your comments. 800-222-KABC, 800-222-5222. We have open lines, and we will continue with more of this, the Frank Sontag Show on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show, Talk Radio 790 KABC. By the way, if you're interested in that story, boys step back, men step forward. Pastor's name was Fred Shuttlesworth. And I hope once my book is done, it's the same title, that part of the proceeds I will give to the Shuttlesworth family who have had a, you know, tough go in recent times. 800-222-KABC. We've got every line open save one. Rowland Highland Park, I'll get you in a few moments. 800-222-5222. What'd you think of my Neil Oliver commentary? Too intense? You know, an interesting little sidebar. I'm not saying I know for fact. We put the podcast up of this program on my website, franksontag.com, and also we're on Rumble. I rarely talk about it. We've got, I don't know, maybe 100 followers. But for whatever reason, last Friday night's program, the 2 hours on Rumble tracked five times greater than any show I've done in 8 months. And so I thought, is it an anomaly? Did I do something different? If you didn't listen to last Friday night, a large part of the program was about, wait for it, your favorite movies. I'm kind of an intense guy. I'm just kind of cut that way. I got radically saved at the age of 54. And I just pray, as Dr. King used to say, I want to be thoroughly used up when I die. We have a men's ministry, a huge event here in LA. I'll talk about shortly. But it's just like, be all in. And I'm almost talking to myself because, again, most of my life I mailed it in. I lived in fear. I was a poser, insecure, father wound, you know, all that stuff. And so when I crack a microphone, and I know there are thousands of people listening, I take this seriously. I try to share stories, not just that are inspiring, but to challenge you to kind of step up. Whether it's the Fred Shuttlesworth story or Neil Oliver. Later in this hour, I'm going to talk about a young 21-year-old woman named Sophie Scholl, who I had never heard of until about 4 months ago. This is a true story. I'll read about what happened to her in the next segment. But how are you? How's your life? Are you sick of hearing all the BS and the mainstream media and all the propaganda and its politics and do you use your time wisely? I sometimes get sucked into the black hole of social media, and I'll track something on Twitter and start watching videos, and the next thing you know, I'm all wound up. And again, I'm not here to mince words. You know, I'll see a video, I'm like, how dumb can the current president be? And I get all messed up and upset, and I reel it back in, and I realize, look, you can control your life. You can control your behavior. You can control the impact that other people have on you. That's primarily about 80% of your life. The other stuff we get caught up in, it is a waste of energy. Just like blame, to me, is a waste of energy. Blame doesn't serve anyone, especially you, but it's popular. Playing the victim is popular. We live in a time, the book I follow in Isaiah talks about there will be a time when good will be called evil, evil will be called good. We're there. Man, lies are now truth. These people in positions of authority lie without any conscience. And I get it. If you understand it's a lie, you're like, this is ridiculous. And then you start feeling powerless. Don't buy into it. Stand strong. Live your life in integrity. You as an individual have such an impact, especially in your immediate circle in your life. But we live in a time by which I believe in my faith that spiritual warfare is at such a heightened cadence, if you will, that we're watching the deterioration of our culture. And good people are dropping like flies. They're tapping out. And especially in my ministry, we say no way. No way. What a time to be alive. What a great time to be alive. What a blessed time to be alive, where you can stand. Do you ever think about legacy? Sophie Scholl is an amazing story. Sometimes we buy the lie of I'm only one person. What can I do? She was only one person. She fought the Nazis. Wait till you hear her story. So why not you? Why not me? And maybe that just simply means fight to be the best parent that you can be for your children. Get involved in their schooling. Man, evil is rearing its ugly head everywhere. But I'll say one last thing, we'll break and come back. We got some calls to get to. 800-222-KABC. But I know in my life, for a lot of years, I went the way of the easy path. You know, the ostrich syndrome. Just bury your head. Live and let live. I don't want to get involved. Why would I push the issue? Why would I confront anything? And it's a lie. It gives you the false sense that somehow, by taking those kind of positions, fill in the blank, you won't be upset, you won't experience a whole array of emotions, is what they are. Feelings that are illusory, they come and go. When the truth is, God made you a certain way. God has a purpose and a plan for your life. He made you like no one else. The tragedy is many people don't choose to take a step forward, maybe in risk, to discover the plan and purpose that God has for their lives. And once you do take that first step, oh, life gets really interesting then. I'll tell you a 90-second story and we'll break and come back. In 1984, June 17th of 1984, some of you know the story. I was rear-ended on my motorcycle by somebody on braking, on trying to stop their momentum, hit us at 110 miles an hour. I had no helmet on. I'm obviously here to talk about it. But if you've ever been in some type of a trauma situation or an accident, stereotypically, many people talk about this experience of everything slows down. And for me, after I got hit and was flying in the air before I hit and made one with the 101 freeway, I experienced a whole life review and I saw I lived my whole life in fear. I compromised everything. I didn't want to push anything. And I remember thinking before I hit, I had a fleeting thought. If I somehow survive this, I'm not going to live my life in fear anymore. And for some of us, it takes a brush with death. For some of us, it takes a wake-up call of some type to go, okay, life is so short anyway, why not go for it? Right? Why not be all in? So that's what I try to impart, at least on this program. 800-222-KABC. I'd love to hear from somebody that's never heard the broadcast before. You can call in and say, man, I'm not sure about you, or I don't like you, or I like what I'm hearing so far. We don't have to get in the weeds about anything deep, but I'd love to hear from maybe new callers that have never either called in or have never heard the program before. 800-222-KABC. By the way, a new sponsor of the program is Berglund & Johnson Law Group. Dan Johnson is a friend of mine. Berglund & Johnson specializes in, well, accidents, auto, truck, motorcycle. If you've been seriously injured, they will take a free call and do kind of a synopsis. And if they take your case, if you do not win, they're not going to take a penny from you. They've been around for more than 40 years. They can help you, and you will never pay anything unless they win your case. And they've got a whole lineage of successful, and they're wonderful people. By the way, sometimes you may not know, but if you see TV ads about lawyers saying they'll really take care of you. Many are actors, of advertising companies placing ads for pools of lawyers, and you have no clue what you're going to get, who's going to represent you. Berglund and Johnson are the real deal. If this resonates with you, call them. 1-800, the number 4-IF-HURT. 1-800-4-IF-HURT. It is the Berglund and Johnson Law Group, and tell them I sent you. And tell them thank you for supporting this radio program. This is the Frank Sontag Show, Talk Radio 790 KABC. Talk Radio 790 KABC. Welcome to the Frank Sontag Show. By the way, if you miss any of this broadcast, you can listen to the entire podcast simply by going to franksontag.com. This break, this segment's going to be a little short. At the 8 o'clock hour, first segment, we're going to take all the calls on the screen. So if you've called in, I'll take your calls. If you'd like to call in and get lined up, 800-222-KABC. So the priority will be when we get back, top of the hour, we'll take phone calls for the entire segment. We do have some lines open. Part of the theme tonight, and it wasn't intended, is courage. I want to read a story of a young woman that I had never heard of until a friend of mine who has a ministry called the White Rose Resistance shared her story. Let me just read it to you and try to get it in the time we have. Among the lesser-known heroes from Nazi Germany, the White Rose Resistance was a small collective of Christian students who secretly wrote, printed, and distributed literature all around Germany, criticizing the Nazis and inspiring many others to resist them. Initially a member of the Nazi youth, Sophie Scholl's deep Christian faith insulated her from Nazi propaganda, which convinced many young people that Jewish people were subhuman and should be treated as such. As soon as Sophie encountered a pamphlet from the White Rose Resistance, her heart was stirred to action. Imagine her surprise when she discovered that the resistance was being led by none other than her older brother, Hans. At a mere 21 years old, with dreams of becoming a teacher, Sophie joined the resistance. She didn't believe this was a brave or exceptional act. It was simply Christianity lived out, or as Sophie put it, we are Christian and we are German, therefore we are responsible for Germany. After several months of covert operations, the White Rose Resistance took things to the next level. February 18 of 1943, during class time, Sophie and her brother walked the halls at the University of Munich, placing hundreds of their leaflets in the open. Just before the bell rang, Sophie shoved an entire stack of leaflets from the third-floor balcony down to the atrium below. Unfortunately, the janitor caught her in the act. Sophie and her brother were sentenced to death by guillotine. Though she was the youngest of the resistance members, Sophie spoke with a depth well beyond her years. She understood that the blame lay not with evil men, for those men will always exist. Rather, as Sophie eloquently explained, quote, the real damage is done by those millions who want to survive. The honest men who just want to be left in peace. Those who don't want their little lives disturbed by anything bigger than themselves. Those with no sides and no causes. Those who won't take measure of their own strength for fear of antagonizing their own weakness. Those who don't like to make waves or enemies. Those for whom freedom, honor, truth, and principle are only literature. End quote. Sophie's courage and calm disturbed even her captors, who were so moved that they relaxed the rules to allow Hans and Sophie to meet with their parents one last time before their execution. Remember Jesus, Sophie, were her mother's final words to her doomed daughter. Yes, she said, but you too, Mama. On the eve of their beheading, February 22 of 43, Sophie spoke some of her final words. She said, how can we expect righteousness to prevail when there is hardly anyone willing to give themselves up individually to a righteous cause? Such a fine sunny day, and I have to go. But what does my death matter if, through us, thousands of people are awakened and stirred to action? As the blade prepared to fall, Sophie said, the sun still shines. 80 years ago, They were facing the same ideology that we are today. The victims then were the Jews. It's the unborn children today. But there is always a new iteration of those the eugenicists and secular humanists define as unfit to live. Sophie believed that through her death, thousands would be awakened and stirred to action in her final days. She shared with her cellmate, Elsie Gebel, that there would be a student revolt following their execution. And in the few brief moments with her mother before the end, she said, "What we did will cause waves." Except, no waves of courage followed. No student revolt happened. And the church in Germany wasn't stirred to action. Although rose blossoms may perish with the fall, they reappear in the spring. While the members of the White Rose were all found and executed, their sacrifice planted the seeds of resistance in the hearts of countless men and women whose actions keep alive the legacy of the White Rose. While we face a silent and far more deadly Holocaust, your sacrifice will water the seeds of resistance. Thousands will be awakened and stirred to action. The White Rose will blossom again, and we can say the sun still shines. Seth Gruber is a dear friend of mine, and he heads up the White Rose Resistance today. Please go to this website, be informed, get involved. The website is thewhiterose.life. Thewhiterose.life. Sophie Scholl, one young woman who realized that indeed her life may have been short, but it was about being courageous and standing out and fighting against evil, standing against evil. She reminds me of part of the reason why we're going to get together tomorrow morning. There's an event here in Los Angeles, locally, starting at 9 a.m. It is absolutely free. We're going to feed you breakfast. We're going to feed you lunch. It's from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and it's locally here at actually quite a historic place that was built 100 years ago. If you want to find out more details and information, go to franksontag.com. We are going to live stream it, but it may be too late to register to get the link. I'm not sure on that one. But I do hope you come. I've gotten emails from guys saying, well, and it is a men's event, by the way. Well, it's going to rain. I don't know if I'm going to make it. I'm thinking, dear Lord, seriously. I mean, look, I don't want to speak ill of anybody. And I've got 2 minutes to break. And I want to just be honest. You can judge me any way you want. I'm not one to have powerful dreams. I had a dream last night. And it was real simple. It was a mother pulled up to where we're going to do this tomorrow with her young son in the car. And she said, "Take my son, please. I'm concerned about his eternity." And I woke up. Now, you can interpret that the way you want, but I think this is a call for men to step up and be men of God, fathers, husbands, brothers. You know, we have something going on in the country where you start hearing the R word revival. I don't know if you're tracking about what's going on in certain parts of the country. Something may break out tomorrow. And by the way, last thing I'll say, we are not a church ministry. So you're not going to get real heavy. We're not going to share a lot of the Bible. Maybe you're not even a believer. If you're a man, come to the event. Goodness, take an extra 10 minutes and drive, and maybe if we have a little rain tomorrow. But your life just may change. Or I don't know if you still can, but go to franksontag.com. Maybe you can still get the link to watch the live stream. But that's tomorrow. Lives will be changed, and we're looking forward to it. Hour number two is upon us. We're going to take calls. Raul, Nick, Brent, and others, 800-222-KABC. What's on your mind? Would you like to share anything, questions, comments, about something you've heard tonight, or maybe just anything. Love to hear from you. Next segment will be phone calls only, 800-222-KABC. We continue with more of the Frank Sontag Show next. Talk Radio 790 KABC.